This is lesson four, sit rep, where Christ is not named. So this lesson aims to be something like a situation report describing the need, the global need for the gospel and where we ought to direct our missions efforts and endeavors. So the introduction there says, understanding the status of the church worldwide. In other words, where is the church thriving? Where is the church yet to penetrate? And under that, two little questions that we hope to find answers to in this lesson. First of all, how many people in the world have yet to hear the gospel? And in this course, we have tried to make the case that those people that have never heard the gospel are the primary targets of Great Commission efforts, as opposed to people that have heard the gospel and rejected it. People that are unbelievers, but they are unbelievers who have been approached with the gospel. They've heard the gospel in some way. Those people in the world that have not heard the gospel ought to be the primary targets for our missions endeavors. And second, where is there a great need for foreign church planters? And as we've tried to make the case that missionary work, especially missionary work that we put our financial support behind, is the deployment of a foreign worker to another field, to another place, to evangelize, to preach the gospel, and to establish new churches. And so our question is, where in the world are those places where we most need church planters, so much so that it's worth us sending people from one country to another to plant those churches? So to get started on these questions, we want to analyze the world's unheards. And again, unheards, we're just using this word to refer to those people that have never heard the gospel before. And this is probably a trickier thing to analyze than we might think, and so we're going to talk about how we do this. But what we want to, the conception that we want to aim at here is that we want to conceive of the world's need in terms of supply and not in terms of demand. So what's the difference between supply and demand? If I told you that in my city there was a great need for Starbucks, how could I tell if that was a true statement or a false statement? Well, you can't tell just by asking people how much Starbucks they drink, because everybody in the town may drink very little Starbucks, but that does not mean that there's a need for, there's some kind of shortage of Starbucks coffee in the city. There may be Starbucks coffee in the grocery stores, and there may be multiple Starbucks, you know, coffee shops, and people are just not partaking. They are not taking advantage of the Starbucks that is there. So simply finding that there's not a demand for Starbucks does not mean that the answer is start more Starbucks because people can't get to it. So when we talk about the Great Commission and we talk about church planning, the fact that there may be some places where there are a great number of people who do not partake of the supply does not mean that we need to supply more. So we may find some places where there is a very low demand for the gospel, but that does not mean that there's a supply problem. And so really we want to put most of our attention, when we analyze the need of a place, our biggest question is not, is there a demand here for the gospel? The question is there a supply of the gospel here? For example, in the United States, a lot of post offices are in a lot of trouble. And so people might say, well, we need more post offices because people aren't using the post office. Well, it may be true if it can be shown that people live too far away from a post office or there's some other problem that's keeping them from taking advantage of the post office. But the simple fact that people aren't using the post office doesn't mean people aren't communicating with other people by mail. They may have found other ways to do it. So in the church, when we talk, we want to make our primary concern to be supply, not demand. But here's a few things. I wanted to put down some demand considerations on here because I find that very frequently when we hear a missionary or a church planter describe the need in a place, they tend to use terms of demand, and I think that's not very helpful. And here are several demand considerations you may hear. First of all, whether or not churches are in decline. So people may describe an area and say, well, there's a lot of churches that the churches are dying, they're shrinking, they're shriveling up, and the people are leaving, and the pews are empty, and the pulpits are empty, and the churches are closing down. That does not necessarily mean that there's a supply problem there. That does not mean that necessarily people there have no access to the gospel. That's a measurement of demand, whether or not there may still be enough churches there that are evangelizing and effectively inviting the people of that region to church, and the people are simply rejecting it. They're not interested, but it doesn't mean there's a labor problem there that we need to send in more laborers. Second, whether or not there are many unbelievers. There is no place that I've ever been to that I know of anywhere in the world that could not claim to have many unbelievers. But the simple fact that there's a great number of unbelievers there is simply a question of demand. It simply expresses that there are people there are not Christians. It does not explain whether or not those people have had a chance to hear the gospel. It doesn't explain whether or not they know believers and whether they've been witnessed to. And so when we talk about that there's a lot of unbelievers there, that in itself does not prove that we need more laborers there. What it simply says is they may need more laborers, they may not, but it simply describes the current spiritual condition of the place. Third, whether or not unbelievers understand the gospel. This is a very common one. You'll hear missionaries say that they talk to people in their field and the place where they want to start a church, and the people there, they don't understand the gospel. Well, frankly, no unbeliever really understands the gospel. Only believers really understand the gospel. So to demonstrate that an unbeliever doesn't understand the gospel, that there's a great amount of confusion. And what this shows us, I think, is that you can't discover whether or not people have heard. Remember, we're trying to find the unheards. You can't tell if a person is an heard or an unheard just by asking them, usually. Because they may have been witnessed to, they may have heard the gospel, they may have been invited to church many times, and it all just went right over their head, it bounced right off of them, it made no impact on them whatsoever, there was no conviction of sin that attended to it. And so if you want to find out how many unheards are in an area, it's not a good idea just to go ask people, have you heard the gospel? Because almost every unbeliever will tell you that they've never heard the gospel, even though there may have been somebody in the background who has been continually and faithfully giving them a gospel witness. Okay, another example of a demand consideration is whether or not they want missionaries to come. And this works both ways. You'll find some places where the local people will say, we want more missionaries to come. Well, that doesn't prove, that's just a demand consideration. There may be enough missionaries to do the job there, and the people just like missionaries, so they think more missionaries is a good thing. Conversely, there may be a place where they don't want missionaries, and the people don't like missionaries, have a bad attitude about them, and sometimes you'll hear people say this, they don't want the gospel, they're not interested in the gospel, so let's just leave them be. Let's go to those places where they have a desire for the gospel. Frankly, those are both demand considerations, and they should both be cast out. The question is, are there enough laborers in that place to provide those people with a witness to the gospel? Whether or not they want us there is totally irrelevant. Another example is whether or not they're receptive to the gospel. This is similar to the one before. Some missionaries say, well, I want to go to this field because the people there are very interested in the gospel and they're very open to it. And I don't want to work in a place where people, they don't appreciate the gospel, they don't care about the gospel. And some of you hear missionaries say that here in America, people don't care to hear the word preached. People don't care to hear the gospel. But over there, people will flock to hear it. So that is not a good reason to go to a place or not to go to a place. You haven't actually measured the need there. You've only described the demand. And again, the same is true the other way. There are some people who do not have any interest in going to some places. For instance, maybe in the Arab world or in a strongly Buddhist country, Thailand or something. And people don't have an interest in going to those places because they are less fruitful or perceived as less fruitful, so they have no interest in going there. Another one, it's not written here, but sometimes another demand consideration. People often talk about how immoral a place is or how ungodly a place is. And again, that is not something that we should really factor in when we consider the need of a place. That doesn't measure whether or not these people have heard the gospel. It only describes their current spiritual condition. And a person who lives a very upright, moral sort of life is in just as much need of the gospel as somebody who lives a wicked, immoral life. And so we're not just measuring how bad this place is, okay? So the fact that there's a lot of alcoholics in your place, or that there's a high divorce rate or a high suicide rate in this area, does not mean that they need more foreign church planters. Now, how are we going to go about asking these questions about supply? How do we determine if people are getting the gospel? Again, we can't really ask them. If you ask them, they don't really know if they've been getting the gospel or not. So here's three things that we can consider as we talk about the questions of supply. First of all, I think probably the most relevant, the most important, if not the only one, but one of the most important considerations we can make is the percentage of believers in a place. Okay, so in this town, in this city, in this region, what percentage of the people are believers? Now, generally, these statistics are not, they're often not available for a very specific region, a neighborhood, or a city. Generally, they're available for an entire region and usually for an entire country. And so this can be, I say in the third thing there, we'll come back up to the ones above, but it says national statistics can be misleading as believers may be concentrated in certain areas. For example, this is the case in India, where in the southern part of India, as I understand, there are certain places, there are certain pockets that have a high concentration of believers, whereas you go to other areas and you may find there are very few believers. So national statistics aren't, they can be a little bit misleading, but regardless, this number is very is of interest to us. We want to know how many believers in a place. Why? Okay. First of all, there, this tells us something about how likely an unbeliever is to meet and hear the gospel from a believer. So, if one out of every 10 people in a region is a born again believer, then it's very likely that most of the people in the area will have met a believer before and know a believer. Okay. And when you talk about a place like the United States, which is something like 28.9% evangelical Christian. That's not people who claim to be Christian. That's people who claim to be a born-again, Bible-believing sort of Christian. People are, almost everybody in the United States will know a Christian. Okay, whether or not they understand the gospel or whether what kind of life they live, they may know a Christian. And if the number is very low in some countries, say below 1%, If the percentage of believers in a country is something very low, like less than 1%, it is very likely that that a person in this country can live their whole life and never meet a Christian, especially if you consider that some of those believers may be concentrated in certain regions. And so in places like that, that has to tell us there must be a high unheard factor here. And it also tells us something about the size of the task for the local believers. If you have, say, half of 1% of Christians in a particular area, that means in order for everyone in this region to hear that half of 1%, on average, each believer must be responsible for sharing the gospel with approximately 200 people. And so the task for them is very large, and that indicates to us that that may be an area where we want to help with that task. The second supply consideration would be local churches. And this is perhaps when you could, like I said, on the regional level, often the statistics for percentage of believers are unavailable. And so sometimes when you're analyzing a smaller area, a region, a city, it's easier to count local churches and to see how many members they have and how healthy they are. So first of all, right here, churches are centers of gospel proclamation and discipleship. Counting gospel preaching churches is key for understanding an area's need. Again, oftentimes those believers in some countries are concentrated in some areas. In China, I think it's the same, mainly because most of the numbers I hear about the percentage of believers in China don't gel with what we see in the city where we are. And I've been told by some people that there are certain cities in China that have a very high concentration of believers, and that might skew the national statistics. But if we want to understand something about an area, if we want an accurate understanding of what the progress of the gospel is like in a particular area, one of the best places we can start is by measuring local churches, going out and finding the churches in an area. So what does this have to do with unheards? Well, a church is a center of proclamation, or at least it should be. And so when you see a church, it gives you an indication that this is a center for the removing of the unheard factor, that because of this group of believers that they should be doing something to eliminate the unheards in an area. And also, it also tells you that there are existing believers there. So if you were to move to this area, it would be important for you to know, are my efforts to reach unheards, are they overlapping with this group's efforts to reach the unheards, and are we reaching the same unheards? And again, it can be tricky to know because an unheard doesn't know that they've heard the gospel from two different people. They don't know they've heard the gospel from one person. They don't know they've heard the gospel from anybody. And so you can have multiple groups who are effectively giving a witness to the same group of people and not even realizing that their efforts are almost totally overlapped. The next little point there, the health of the evangelical churches in an area must be individually assessed. Is the gospel being truly preached to the region's unheard? To the region's unheards? The other thing to take in consideration is obviously not every church should register the same on our scale of gospel witness. Some churches are extremely lethargic and extremely inactive in their gospel witness. And so in calculating the need of a place, that church's contribution should be figured very low. But then other churches are, in proportion to their size, are extremely evangelistic, and they provided a strong witness to the area, and that obviously must be factored very high. A third supply consideration would be missionary endeavors, existing missionary endeavors. And I would say of the three, this is certainly the least important of these supply considerations. But okay, we want to analyze an area and say, are the people in this area hearing the gospel? Number one, how many believers are there? Are those and how likely is an unbeliever to know a Christian and likely to have heard a witness from them? What percentage of the people live close to a church, and how many of them, and how active is that church in providing a witness? That tells us something very important as well. And another thing is existing missionary efforts. Who are the missionaries there, and what are they doing? What are their projects like? And that has to be analyzed just like local churches. In some countries, this can be difficult because missionaries may be in hiding. But generally, if that's the case, then you can pretty much factor out their contribution. If they're in hiding, they're probably not making a considerable contribution to eliminating the unheard factor anyway. Below, it is theoretically possible, keyword theoretically, that a missionary in a place is effectively eliminating the unheard factor, though response is overwhelmingly negative. What I mean by that, it is possible that a missionary could be in a neighborhood, in a community, and that he could be, in effect, providing a recurring witness to a large area, and he has nothing, there's little or no fruit, he has very little to show for it. It's theoretically, but it's unlikely, and when it comes to missionaries, it's far more likely if a missionary has no fruit to show that it's very often the case that they are not actually providing as strong of a witness as they believe they are, and the same can be true of churches. But if you want to understand the need of an area, this factor and this possibility has to at least be calculated. A little side note here I included is missionaries wishing to join up with a missionary team should articulate the contribution they're planning to make. What I primarily mean there is they should articulate to potential supporters. If a missionary comes to our church soliciting support and they say, I'm going to join up with this missionary in X place, the question that we really need to ask is, what is your actual contribution going to be towards eliminating the unheard factor in this place? And really, we need to justify, why are both of you needed there? If the missionary is there to eliminate the unheard by providing a recurring gospel witness and to plant new churches, then really the burden of proof, we'll talk about that in a second, the burden of proof is on the missionary to demonstrate that his presence there is not just providing that overlap. And I think we won't take the time to look at it because I think you will see it and inevitably see it in another lesson. But in Romans, where Paul talks about how his desire, and in 2 Corinthians, where Paul talks about his desire to primarily work in those places where Christ is not named, we should almost certainly take that to mean that in Paul's mind, he did not want his gospel preaching efforts to overlap with other people's gospel preaching efforts. And if there's a significant factor of overlap as a missionary or as a church planner, then you are likely not in a needy enough place. There are many, many places in this world where you could go and work and have no significant overlap, that your works, that your proclamation of the gospel would be on almost completely untouched territory. And those places aren't as rare as they are often imagined to be. So with these three supply considerations in mind, let's go to letter E, describing the needs. So how do we put all this together and compare the needs of different areas? So how do we compare the need of area A to area B, to these two regions? First of all, we do not need to concern ourselves with what I'm calling the statistics of potentials. What does that mean? For example, whether or not believers in an area could reach neighboring areas, whether or not people in an area could hear a radio broadcast, or whether or not a particular church could change their theological tendencies. Let me see if I can describe what I mean by that. When I say the statistics of potentials, this overlooks everything that all the numbers that we know about, how many unbelievers there are, how low that factor is. It overlooks the number of good churches and the good number of good missionaries, and it looks at potentials, and it says, well, there are some believers there. Let's say there's 2% evangelical believers in this area, and theoretically, if those believers were all passionate witnesses for Christ, they were all bold witnesses for Christ, they could effectively reach their area. That's a potential thing, and it's not something actual. It's something that we think might, could possibly happen. We hope it will happen. We may pray to that end, but it has not happened, and we don't know if it ever will happen. Another example is whether or not people in the area could hear radio broadcasts. Okay, so some people say, well, I don't want to go to this area because those people, they could hear the gospel if they turned on the radio, if they turned on the TV, if they got the right satellite, if they're on the right satellite network, if they, you know, went to the bookstore, or, you know, if they went to this church that was on the other side of the town. If they were really seeking, they could really find. Another example is whether or not a particular church could change their theological tendencies. So people may look at an area and say, well, this place is nominally Christian. So they have Bibles, the people grow up, they're baptized, and the people all claim to be Christians, and they're in church all the time. And they could, if they would read their Bibles closely enough, they could come to true faith in Christ. And all of those statistics we can effectively discount. We are not called to measure to imagine potential situations. Wherever there are people that have not heard the gospel and are not hearing the gospel, as we can tell by our supply consider, where there is not a supply of the gospel, we have a responsibility to consider how can we put a supply in that area. Not hope and imagine that maybe someday a supply might emerge, but how can we have just as much responsibility in those places where we could conceive, where we can somehow think up of some way where the gospel might be in supply there in the future someday, versus those places where we cannot imagine, because frankly our imaginations are limited anyway. Nor do we deny responsibility for an area where there are national believers. This is one of the big things I'm getting at. There is a tendency in modern missiology to label certain areas as reach because they reach a critical mass of believers. Say, usually the number thrown out is 2%. And so the idea is that there's 2% believers, they can go and they can reach their own people. There's a few problems with that. Like I said before, sometimes those believers are concentrated in one area. But we are not at liberty to deny our responsibility for the 90 or for whatever percentage of those people that have not heard the gospel before. There are no unheards in the world that it's okay for us to be unconcerned with. Our question is only, what is the best way for us to reach those unheards? There's no one that we can safely cross off and say, we don't have to worry about these unheards because there's already people who will take care of it. The question is not whether they ought to take care of it. The question is whether they are taking care of it. And if they are not, then they are still part of our responsibility. That does not mean that necessarily we should send a foreign church planter there. That's not what I'm saying. But we have to consider some kind of a plan that involves them. It's not safe for us to discount them. Second, it's not finally a matter of marking an area or a group as reached or unreached because there is always more Great Commission work to do in a place. It is better perhaps to think of a need continuum. So there's never a time, again, we've talked about this before, where we just cross off a place and say, this place is done. There's always more Great Commission work to do because the Great Commission is not only evangelize the lost, the Great Commission also includes the perfecting of the saints. It includes the continual edifying, exhorting, and training of new believers. And so there's always something to do with the Great Commission. So we should probably think of a need continuum, places that are very needy, of the places that need this kind of work and places that need this kind of work and everything in between. So there's some places where there are effectively no believers and no one providing a gospel witness. These people need a plan that will first of all go into this area, provide a gospel witness, and then train. And then there's other areas where the other end of the continuum where people are clearly have plenty of opportunities. There are many churches and many believers who are working to provide a gospel witness to their community. And what's really needed there is continual perfecting of the saints and continual efforts at evangelism. Our definition of missions that we've been talking about is sending foreign church planters. Obviously, those belong primarily on this end of the continuum. So as we think of this need continuum, it tells us that there are different things that need to be done in different places. And that's what the next little blank there says. The final decision is whether the existing need in a particular place is best met by sending a full-time church planting missionary. This is a very expensive, very costly, and a very particular plan. And it simply does not match with every kind of need. So we can't just say, well, there's a need for something to be done in this area. There's still unbelievers. There's a lot of, the churches are in decline, or any of those demand considerations we saw in number one. None of those things answer the question for us, do we need foreign church planters there? They only establish that we need something there. And the sending of a foreign church planter is a very specific, it's a very particular, and at that, a very costly plan. And we should use that method primarily in those places that have a high degree of unhurts, where there is a low supply of the gospel. To send in a church planting missionary is in essence to send in a fountainhead. It's to go and to plant a place that is going to provide a strong new gospel witness in an area. And if there's already a good number of gospel witnesses in an area, what you're going to do is have a significant amount of overlap. And so this is a particular plan, and we want to look for a particular kind of place to utilize it. So when a missionary comes soliciting support from us, or a missionary comes to us with a proposed plan, our primary question is not, is there a need in this place? Because inevitably, a missionary will be able to prove that there is some kind of a need for something in his area. The question is that need best met by sending a foreign, full-time, church-planting missionary? Now, on that note, the next bullet there says, when are additional church planting projects no longer a wise investment? At what point can we say, okay, we're not saying there's nothing to be done in this area, we're not saying it doesn't matter, but at what point do we say we do not any longer need new church planting efforts in this area? And the summary I give there is when there are no longer neighborhoods without a gospel preaching church. And in this regard, the national statistics are relatively unimportant. So the United States of America, 28.9% evangelical, you could say, well, it's extremely unlikely that you will find a community in the United States that does not have a gospel preaching church. And that's true. If theoretically you could find a community in the United States that does not have a gospel preaching church, then by all means, let's consider how can we start a church in that area, and we should talk about what the best plan is for that. But if there are places that already have a significant number of gospel preaching churches, then it calls at least into question the wisdom of sending an overlapping work into that area. Okay, and I want to hit this next point here, and hopefully you all will discuss this in a little bit. If church planters are filling their church plants, with transfers from other gospel preaching works, the need for their efforts is surely called into question. This is a result of what happens when we focus too much on demand considerations. When we say, well, there is a need for the gospel in this area in the sense that there are many unbelievers, that the churches are in decline, the people are ungodly and immoral, the people live miserable lives, the people want missionaries to come, etc. Is that what happens is you send a church planter where there are already a significant number of church planting works, and the church planter starts a church, and people start to come to the church. So, for example, in Middletown, Ohio, multiple churches will have been started in Middletown, Ohio this year. And if you ask any one of those church planters why they started a church in Middletown, Ohio, every one of them will say, I started a church here because there's a lot of people in Middletown who don't go to church. There's a lot of people in Middletown who are unbelievers. Well, those are what we call demand considerations. That's saying there's still a need here, there's still unbelievers here, but that does not measure whether or not those people have been to church before, whether they've heard the gospel before, whether they have acquaintances and friends that are believers. But the easy way to tell if this is true in this particular church planter's case is simply to survey the people that are filling his pews, or his folding chairs more likely, is to ask the people that they've come to their church, what was your spiritual condition before you came to this church? And if all the people that are coming to the new church plant were believers before they came to this church, they came from another church, or they hadn't been in church for a while, but they were mad at some church, and they came to this church, but if there's not evangelistic growth in this church, if there's no one in this church, or very few people in this church anyway, who were not unbelievers before they came to this church, then the legitimacy of this church plant is surely called into question. And even if it isn't, the burden of proof is still on that church planter to demonstrate that he could not have partnered with an existing overlapping church in the area instead of start a new church. Could those few unbelievers that have become believers of their church, could they not have become believers and joined up with an existing church? Why is there exactly a need for there to be a new church in this area? Next, the burden of proof lies on the financially supported missionary to demonstrate the need of his field, especially in places with fewer unheards. I'll highlight that part about financially supported. A lot of this stuff, see, if you say this stuff too dogmatically, some people will say, well, are you saying this person can't go here or they shouldn't go here? the truth is that we are not another man's master, and if they desire to go and start a church in Alabama, or they desire to go start a church in Middletown, Ohio, then they have certainly they're free to do so. But the question is that when we as a church are considering who are we going to support financially, we do get a vote. We do have some say in what people are going to do as we vote with our finances. And so as our church looks at our limited financial resources and we decide how are we going to budget this, how are we going to use it to maximize its impact around the world, then yes, I say that we should focus that money primarily in those places that have a high unheard factor. And if a missionary comes to our church, goes to another church, soliciting support and asking churches to support them, then yes, I think it is very legitimate for those churches to ask, what are your plans for eliminating the unheard factor? What is the unheard factor like in your area? And how are you planning to eliminate it? And if that person is still very convinced that there's need in a place, especially needs that are not church planning. So very often people say, well, we don't need another church in this area. What we need is we need an orphanage, or we need a crisis pregnancy center, or we need an after-school children's program, we need a sports program, then you should be encouraged to go do that and meet that need on your own dime, or to go join a local church and to work with that church to see it through. But do not come to our church and solicit support, financial support, that could be going to areas in the world where the people have not heard the gospel. The last little bullet point in this section is we do not need to invest our resources in the neediest places in the world. We only need to use them to put laborers in places of real need. Pay attention to that first part about we do not need to invest our resources in the neediest places in the world. And this is a mistake, I think, that a lot of aspiring missionaries, prospective missionaries make, is that they want to find the neediest, the reddest area on the map, the darkest red. They want to go there with the lowest possible percentage of unbelievers. The truth is that once you dip below a certain percentage, effectively, you're doing the same thing. For instance, where I work, I do not think that Harbin is probably over 5% evangelical believers. I think it's probably in the ballpark of 1 or 2%. But effectively, it's the same as working in a place that would have a much lower rate. And the average person does not know Christians. If a person does know Christian, they may know one, or you may meet one person who knows a whole bunch of Christians. But most people do not know many. So it's a very high kind of need. So we don't need to find the neediest places in the world. Okay, we don't need to only put our financial support into the reddest places on the map, but we do need to be concerned that the money that we do put into the map is going to places that is working toward eliminating the unheard factor. In the next section, we want to ask the question, who actually are these unheards? To what religious faith do they belong? And so number two just says the approximate numbers of religious adherents worldwide. Again, world population, around 7 billion. And out of that, letter A, Christianity represents about 2.2 billion, depending who you count, who you don't count, which is about coming up on 32%, or almost a third of the world population. Right at half of that would be Catholic. And obviously, Catholics are centered primarily in European countries and South America and even some African countries. Then you got some Orthodox groups, some other groups. And then there's three groups here that are actually overlapping. They're listed separately, but they actually overlap a bit. So you have Protestantism, which is 800 million. So any Protestant denominations would represent 800 million out of that 2.2 billion Christians. Then you have the Pentecostal and Charismatic groups, which are 600 million. Again, there's overlap there. And then a third overlapping group would be Evangelical Christians, which doesn't include all Protestants, which would be 500 million, which is right at about a little over a quarter of the total number of professing Christians. So as a percentage of the world population, that would be 7.1%. So about 7% of the world population of 7 billion people would profess to be an evangelical Christian. And then below that, we've kind of listed out the other major religious groups in the world. Islam with 1.5 billion, and they are centered in North Africa, the Middle East, some of the Central Asian countries. And then this big group that often gets lost when we talk about religion just because of what they are, the secular non-religious category, which is just over a billion, obviously includes much of China, which is kind of misleading because often when we think of atheists, we think of a sort of militant, scientific, rationalist. That certainly doesn't describe much of the atheism in China or many other countries. And also these atheists, these pockets of secular people are also found in parts of Europe. Then Hinduism, 900 million, you know, that's India, South Asia. Chinese traditional religion, obviously, mainly China. And then Buddhism with 376 million, which includes parts of India, China, Thailand, some other Southeast Asian countries. Then you have some primal indigenous religious groups, around 300 million, African traditional religions, around 100 million. So these are the kinds of places that we need to be sending missionaries to. And it would probably be an interesting exercise for those who are leading missions programs at our church and other churches to consider the breakup of our missionary force. What percentage of our missionaries are working in Islamic nations? What percentage of our missionaries are targeting secular peoples? How many of them are working with Hindus? It's very common for churches to discover that they have many, many missionaries working in Catholic areas or in nominally Christian areas, and they have relatively few that are working with some of these other religious groups. Number three, we want to say where are these? We kind of touched on it a little bit as we mentioned where those religious groups are, but we want to say a little more specifically, and I've provided a map, and if you want to find that map, you can search for the map is a population density map for the world that's put out, I believe, by the International Mission Board. And this is a great map. It shows population density, which tells us, again, if we're targeting, we want to reach as many unheards as possible, and we want to significantly reduce the unheard factor in a region, then a missionary should naturally be concerned with how many preaching targets will be in close proximity to him, that if he sets up his base of operations in a particular place, how many people are in a reasonable radius to him that he will be able to make contact with them and to actually engage them with the gospel. And sometimes we think of nations in terms of their total population, but a map like this shows us where people actually live. In the next lesson, we're going to talk about cities and urbanization. We're going to talk about that in depth a little bit more, and about the importance of having those preaching targets in close proximity. Letter B there, it also shows us what percentage Christians make of their communities. That's another great thing about this map. It's the different colors on the map correspond to a percent of evangelical Christians in this area. And each dot there represents so many people. And so by looking at the dots and how many dots there are, how close together they are, and what color they are, we can kind of get a feel for, in an area, how many Christians there are and what percentage of their population the Christians make. Let us see, the scale and its corresponding colors are somewhat misleading and do not show the true size of the imbalance. But the idea is legit. And when I say it's a little bit misleading, here's what I mean. Sometimes the green areas, there's green areas on the map, and they're below global averages for Christianity. If you remember in the last section, we said that evangelical Christians represent something like 7% of the world's population. So some of these areas that are shaded green here are actually below that 7%. And so now I think they get that from their feeling green is good, and these areas are in the green because they're higher than 2%, which is what often people groups-based strategies, they kind of have this magic number 2%, and so anything above that they feel is pretty good, hence they shade it green. Another area I think this map is slightly misleading is that the darkest green on the map only shows 10% and above. And the truth is that some of these areas are much above 10%, and that's what the letter D below is going to show. The countries with the highest percentage of evangelicals. Now, I limited this to populations larger than 500,000. There are countries that claim to have extremely high percentages of evangelical Christians among their population, but usually those are very, very tiny countries, or island nations or something like that. But these are major nations, over 500,000 people, that have the highest percentage of evangelicals in the world. And it goes from Kenya at 48%, and the list goes down to New Zealand at 18%. And if you look at some of these countries, you see the United States kind of right there in the middle of the list. And the United States is right around 29% of its population professes to be evangelical Christian. And so the green on the map here doesn't really show the full spread.
There are some areas that are the darkest green that are at 10%, and there are some of the other places that are the darkest green, the same color, but they're actually three or four times higher of a percentage of evangelical Christians. So what the map fails to represent, I think, is just how large the imbalance is in some cases. And then the way I probably don't fully appreciate the way they're using the colors here is that, like, the orange, you know, which is supposed to give us a feel of sort of an average, of an average area that isn't doing too great, isn't doing too bad. These orange areas, and then the darkest red on the map, the most emergency levels, are actually, in effect, they're going to be very similar. That some of these places that seem, on paper, if you talk about percentage-wise, some of the places that essentially have no Christians there, and then some of the places with very, very few Christians there, from a missionary's perspective, working in that place is going to be very similar. That the average person on the street has not heard the gospel before, or maybe knows no Christians. And so even though this orange and the darkest red, which represents, you know, a fairly big chunk of the color spectrum on this map, doesn't really show the where the real imbalance lies. And the real imbalance lies, those green areas, some of those green areas are much greener than they are, and some of those areas that are shaded green should probably be the orange or even red. So letter E, I want to say, what does the spread of these of evangelical Christians look like? As you spread them across the world, where are they? And the map shows us a little bit of that. But I wanted to break it down by region, and again, this isn't terribly helpful in a lot of cases, because even within these large swaths of the global map, there's going to be a significant amount of difference from one nation to another nation, from one region, from one city to another. There's going to be some variance. But this does kind of give us a bit of a snapshot, for whatever that's worth, of the world. And if you look down the list of the areas, you'll see the ones that are in the higher, you know, that are beating the global average. If you notice, it's interesting, there's very few regions that are right around the global average, around 7%. Most of them are either far, far above that or far, far below that. So North America, 27%, the Caribbean, 14%, Latin America, 17%, down on the middle of the list, West and Central Africa, which is places like Burkina Faso, Chad, the Congo, Ghana, Nigeria, that's around 19% evangelical, 19.2 it says. Eastern and Southern Africa then, with 469 million people, is about 22.3% evangelical. That's Ethiopia, Kenya, Mozambique, South Africa, Uganda, etc. Then down at the bottom, you see 18% evangelical, the South Pacific, which is Australia, the islands, New Zealand. But then if you look at the other regions, you'll see they are considerably below the 7% mark. Western Europe, there at the top, which is an area that we probably don't often think about as being so low, having such a low percentage of evangelical Christians, but around 3%, and this includes the UK, Germany, France, Sweden, Norway, Italy, Western Europe, Eurasia, which is, you know, Albania, Belarus, Greece, Hungary, the Ukraine, that's right around 2%. And then Central Asia, here's where the numbers get kind of scary low, at 0.4%. Which is the Central Asian countries, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Armenia, Iran, Turkey, those countries. Down below there, North Africa and the Middle East, mainly Muslim nations, and they are hanging around 1.2%. Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, you know, Saudi Arabia, all those countries and all the countries in between. Down below there, Northeast Asia, with over a billion, about 1.5 billion people. This is about 5.4% evangelical. This is China, Japan, Korea, Mongolia. So again, below the average. This is a huge number of people, 1.5 billion people. And this is probably one of the less helpful numbers, because it does represent such a large number of people. And the nations within this category can be pretty different, pretty skewed in their numbers of Christians. South Asia, also with nearly 1.5 billion people, is approximately 2% evangelical. This includes India and Sri Lanka and Nepal. And then finally, Southeast Asia, with over 600 million, right at around 5.4% evangelical, just like Northeast Asia. This includes Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, the Philippines. Again, some of these countries are going to throw those numbers off because they're considerably high in comparison to the global average. So there are some countries, letter F, there's some countries, for example, China, where the available data is unreliable and or imprecise. Because a country like China does their best to either to not encourage the growth of religion in their country or to try to ignore it when it is there. So their census data isn't terribly helpful in some of these considerations. And then letter G, this is what I try to say above there, even more than these numbers reveal, so to a greater extent than we can see just by looking at these numbers, due mainly to the demographic variations between countries and even within different regions of countries, some places are still going to have a radically higher percentage of believers than other places, even more so than we can tell just by looking at these numbers. And then in the last section of this lesson, we want to talk about some of the major challenges of modern missions. And that what we mean by that is, what sort of places are they? Not just where are they on the map, but what sort of places are these that are the darkest of the red, that have the lowest percentage of evangelical Christians, that have the fewest churches, that have the fewest missionaries, that have the highest factors, the highest percentage of unheards in their population? What are these places like? And as we prepare to mobilize missionaries, and as we prepare to send missionaries and support missionaries, as we are concerned about sending missionaries into the world, we should both be looking for missionaries who are equipped and prepared and willing and wanting to go to places like this. And we also need to be considering ourselves as we look to the world and considering whether or not we are willing to move to places like this and to work in places like this. So letter A, the first major challenge of modern missions is the challenge of large cities, or you could say the challenge of urbanization. As the world becomes more urbanized as a whole, more and more of the world's unheards are clustered in these dense urban areas. In 2007, supposedly, the world crossed the 50% urbanization mark. Now, sometimes when we say urban, and we'll talk about this in the next lesson as well, but sometimes when we say urban, we imagine gigantic, you know, cities like, you know, New York, Los Angeles. We imagine places like that. But to be honest, that's probably not really exactly what's meant by these urban areas. Often, urban means little more than not farm, not country. And so if you're moving into a city and you've moved off the farm and you're living no longer in a farming village, but you're living in a city, that you are part of that urban group. And so the cities are not necessarily mega cities, but they're nevertheless urban areas. And whereas the people groups model, this is the next little bullet there, whereas the people groups model pushes missionaries toward more rural areas, an unheards model will naturally lead missionaries toward the cities. And we haven't talked about it a lot in this lesson, but the probably the largest contender in the missiological ideas introduced in the 20th century is this people groups conversation that says that we should make sure that the gospel is penetrating into every kind of people. And what that often leads to is that so many of the world's peoples, the people groups, these culturally distinct groupings, have crossed that 2% threshold. And so if you want to find a people group, a culturally distinct people that is under 2%, you are almost certainly going to have to move to a very rural area. And so what happens is advocates of the people groups model are continually pushing toward rural areas, and they're actually going in the opposite direction of the world's population. The world's population is becoming increasingly urban. And as a missionary who conceives of his role instead as reducing the number of unheards in the world, of eliminating that unheard factor, he is going to be most naturally led toward the city, toward an urban environment where there'll be a large number of preaching targets within a small radius. And that's, again, we'll talk about that in the next lesson. As it says in the last bullet point in the following lesson, we'll address some of the advantages and the challenges of urban missions endeavors. So this is the first major challenge that we encounter when we talk about where are we going, what sort of places do we need to be prepared to breach if we want to eliminate the unheard factor.
Okay, letter B, restricted access nations. There are some countries where evangelism and the planting of churches is illegal. There are also countries where the culture at large is hostile to Christianity. So even though only one of these is really the definition of restricted access, I just put it all here under the kind of the same rubric because we have kind of, I think it helps to think of these categories. There are some countries where the work of the ministry is illegal. That is, there are governmental restrictions in place. Included in that would be places like China, where the government has outlawed missionary work and the planting of churches. Okay, they may enforce those laws, they may not enforce those laws, but it is illegal. Then there are other countries where missionaries may have more freedom, technically by the law, but the culture at large is hostile to Christianity. So in those countries, it's not the police that you're worried about, it's the response of the people that you're sharing the gospel with. And then there are some countries like Morocco where really those two things are conflated and you have both dynamics happening at the same time, where you have people in the culture that are hostile to Christianity and you also have political factors working against the spread of the gospel. Okay? But these countries, second bullet point there, these countries are also home to many of the world's unheards. So if we're going to be serious about reaching those people that have not heard the gospel before, it is inevitable that we're going to have to cross into some of these borders. And we have to refer you again to the very beginning. We do not factor in considerations of demand. We don't say, well, they don't want the gospel there, they're not interested in the gospel. That is not our question. Our question is, do they have the gospel? And if they do not, it is our responsibility to take the gospel to them, regardless of how many laws we break or regardless of our reception by the culture. Now, missionaries in these places must be prepared to face the risks of expulsion, separation from their work, and even physical suffering. Okay, and that's obviously in rare circumstances. But if you're going to work in a place like this, if you're going to work in a place where it's illegal to be a missionary, where your church is illegal, where evangelism is illegal, or you're going to work in a place where the people are hostile to the spread of the gospel, then as a missionary, you have to be prepared to face the risks of expulsion. You have to have reckoned with the possibility that you're going to be kicked out of the country, that you could be separated from the work you've started, which is, for most missionaries, the most painful thing, to go to a place to preach the gospel, to plant a church, to be training believers, to be discipling people, and then to have this thing happen that separates you from them, that you're removed from the country and they are forced to carry on without you. That can be one of the greatest stresses of working in a context like this. And in rare circumstances, you may have to be prepared for physical suffering, for actual physical persecution. Okay, and that means also as we send our missionaries, these are also things we want to ask. So think about these things too. Go back to that first one there about the cities, and then this one about the restricted access nations. That when we talk to a missionary who we are considering sending as a missionary, considering supporting him financially, we want to know what kind of a place is he going to be working in. Is he going to be working in a large city? Is he going to be working in a farm town? Is he going to be working in an open, unrestricted context, or is he going to be working in a place where it may be illegal to do what he's doing? Okay, and if he is going to be working in a restricted access nation, what is his approach? Is he willing to face persecution? Is he willing to face the risk of expulsion? Is he going to be so security conscious that he is of no ministerial good in the time that he is in the country? And so these are questions that we need to consider as we want to invest our missions dollars wisely. Letter C, culturally distant contexts. Okay, what I mean by that is, first bullet point, many of the world's unheards are very far removed culturally from those places with a high percentage of believers. So in other words, if we want to go to those places where most people have not heard the gospel, generally those people live in cultures that are extremely foreign to us and that do not make a lot of sense to us. There are many countries in the world that are very westernized and are very globalized at least, where someone from the United States or a Westerner can enter into that context and feel fairly at home, where there's a high degree of continuity between their original culture and the source culture, and the target culture. But most of the world's unheards do not live in places like that. Most of the people in the world that are far removed from the gospel, who've never heard the gospel before, who don't live in places with a high percentage of believers and churches and missionaries, those people, second bullet point, people in these places tend to speak difficult languages, they live in unpleasant climates, they rigidly adhere to false religions, and they keep strange traditions. And so if you go to a place that has a high unheard factor, what are some things that you can expect? Well, you can expect that they're going to speak a very difficult language. Okay, most of the easy languages have already been permeated. Not totally, there's still work to be done, but they have a lower unheard factor than those places that have extremely difficult languages. So places that speak Arabic, Chinese, Thai, Korean, Japanese, These are some of the places that have some of the greatest needs, some of the highest unheard factors. They live in unpleasant climates. So they live in very hot places, very cold places. They rigidly adhere to false religions. Key word, rigidly, is that a lot of the places where the world's unheards live, they are more religious and less nominally so. They may have had a strong upbringing in the religion. They may be very committed to the teachings of the religion. And so those are generally some things we can expect in places with a high unheard factor. And they may have some strange traditions. In other words, just the entire lifestyle may be extremely foreign to the missionary, and that leads to some major problems for missionaries as they come. Okay, the last little bullet point there is: missionaries deployed to these places must be ready for cultural adaptation, acting in love and humility while speaking the gospel boldly and clearly. And we don't spend too much time talking about this cultural adaptation. A future lesson will go in depth talking about what it means for a missionary to adapt to a culture, strategies for adapting to a culture. But this is kind of a key overview, is that the goal for this is that a missionary would be able to act in love and humility and to speak the gospel boldly and clearly in a place like this. But these are the kind of places where we're going to find these unheards, and these are the kind of places where we need to expect our missions dollars to go, our missionaries to go. Our focus is largely going to be on some of these culturally distant contexts. Letter D, less fruitful regions. Many of the places with the most unheards are also the places where response to the gospel is the most negative. So that may sound like it's saying the same thing, but the point it's trying to make is that there are some people in the world that have not heard, and when they do hear, they may be receptive to it. But generally, those are not the places in the world where there's a high unheard factor. If we look at all these places on the map that are red, many of those places are the places where response to the gospel is extremely negative. So it's not just that they haven't heard. It's that when they do hear, they really don't like it, or they have a strong emotional reaction to it. And for example, I give the Arab world. So not only do most people living in the Arab world have they not heard the gospel before, but also their response to it is very negative. And this is important for us to realize because we have a tendency, again, going back to those demand considerations we looked at the beginning of the chapter, beginning of the lesson, we have a tendency to desire, as missionaries and as we send missionaries, we like to hear stories of people flocking to the gospel, of receiving the gospel with joy, and we should. But we like those stories sometimes so much that that's the only kind of place that we want to work, and we don't have categories in our mind for rejoicing in the work of a missionary who goes to a place that brings forth less fruit. So we're really good at rejoicing over reaping, but sometimes we're not as good at, and we need to learn to be better at rejoicing over sowing as much as over reaping. The next point there, missionaries in these places must be prepared to bear rejection, and they must be committed to making an exorbitant investment in a few disciples. So if you're a missionary going to a place like this, and one of the main reasons you're going is because you expect that there's going to be a revival and that you are single-handedly going to change the statistics in that country, then you're probably preparing yourself for a great disappointment. That's not to say that it couldn't happen, but if that's your only category for success, if you're saying, I'm going to go there and it's going to be great, and even though they've had a very low response, a very negative response to the gospel thus far, when I come and preach to them, there's going to be a large response to the gospel. If that's your conception of success, there's a good chance that you'll be very disappointed. Not a good chance that you'll be unsuccessful, but a good chance that you'll be disappointed. So a missionary must be prepared to bear up to rejection, to continue to plow forward with the gospel even when they're rejected. And they must be committed to making an exorbitant investment in a few disciples. And Aaron's going to talk to you more about that, I think, in another lesson. But when a missionary is operating in a place like this, where his future is insecure, he doesn't know what's going to happen, he doesn't know how long he's going to have in this country, and where most people are rejecting the gospel, the missionary must be committed. And this is a question we want to ask. We want to know, is this missionary committed to buckling down and focusing his efforts on a few men and pouring his life into them so that they become faithful men even in a context like this? So it's always important, and I would say as a member of Grace Baptist Church, for example, we want every missionary that we support to be committed to the plan of making disciples. But it is even more important when we are talking about a country like this that a missionary is committed to making disciples, because there's precious little else that the missionary is going to have to show for his time when he's done. If he has poured himself into the lives of a handful of faithful men, then he has truly left a lasting impact in that country. So when we're talking to a missionary, he says he wants to go to a place like this, we want to know, letter C, we want to know, are you prepared to deal with a very different culture? And here in letter D, we want to know, are you prepared to deal with rejection? Do you have a naive view of this country and where you're going? And are you prepared to make a huge investment in a few? Lastly, in these places, we must be reminded that preacher's success is in the process, not the product, or not just the product. Thus, missionaries can be equally successful here. Again, we have to learn to rejoice in sowing and not just in reaping. And we have to not say this is a successful missionary because he has seen X number of people baptized, though that could be something worth rejoicing in. Where there's another category of success for a missionary, that he has significantly lowered the unheard factor in a region, regardless of the response that the gospel has met with there. So we can celebrate successful missionaries who labor in less fruitful regions. So this is kind of what we can expect to find when we aim ourselves toward those places that have a high unheard factor.